volatility and hostility. He came to work angry a lot, and I was his confidant. I was his guy, which I wasn't ashamed of. There were also some swirling statements that Watts made years ago before that were coming back to haunt him. I sat under Bill's learning tree and knew he was not a racist. I saw that very personal relationship Bill had with his black booker, Ernie Ladd, and his top star, another African-American, the Junkyard Dog, which other white promoters would never do in that era. He was also proud to put the WCW world title on Ron Simmons. But him leaving was all about TBS and nothing to do with anything else. He'd come in, shook up the entire division, in good ways and plenty of bad, literally pissed off the 12th floor balcony when he felt like it, and then left again. And when he was gone, I was ostracized. The guy that taught me more than anybody in wrestling was the guy who inadvertently derailed my WCW career. There was absolutely no way the brass was going to consider another Watts-type wrestling person in the vacant position. And, fairly or not, that meant my career in that direction was dead in the water. I needed to start thinking about another path. Chapter 40, My Last Days at WCW, 1993. Watts' vacant role ultimately went to Eric Bischoff. Eric was a wrestling guy who came from the AWA, but very smartly sold himself as the exact opposite. After having Ole and Watts at the helm, Turner had no appetite for another old-school, headstrong type leading the charge. So Eric pitched himself as a brand builder, a businessman with an overall vision for consistency after all the changes to the company. He was young, handsome, and just the type of antidote to Watts the brass wanted. He had served his time in WCW as an announcer who mostly worked on the lower shows, but when the time came to make his case for the head of the department, he positioned himself brilliantly. Eric had street smarts and amazing ambition. Bill Shaw brought me over to his office and told me about the various gripes he had with Watts, from his bombastic nature all the way down to WCW booking Watts' son, Eric, as a wrestler. "Bill Watts has cast a big shadow around here," he said, "and you're still standing right under it." "I'm my own man," I replied. I kind of knew that trying to argue my case was useless. I had already said everything I could say and did everything I could do, but it was like my nearly 20 years in the business didn't mean anything. I was being judged by another man's actions. Shaw continued, "So here's your options from here on out. You can take 6 weeks off to let things cool down." "I don't want to. Just hear me out," he said. "We'll continue to pay you, and you come back when the bad taste has gone out of the place." I didn't want to go anywhere. I knew what it would look like if I followed Watts out the door, even short term. "What's my other option?" I asked. "Well, you accept the reassignment. You keep your official title as vice president of broadcasting, but you'll be working in syndication sales, traveling nationwide to market WCW shows to various local TV affiliates across the country. You'll also be working behind the scenes with the announcers on the Sunday WCW show on TBS, the show I created." I felt like Leroy McGurk's smoldering testicles. He continued, "If you take the 6 weeks, I might be able to get you back on the air when you get back." Shaw knew that was the position I wanted to keep most. "How are you going to get me back on the air?" I asked, when Bischoff specifically said he doesn't want me calling the shows. "You don't have to worry about Bischoff," Shaw replied. "He works for me." I immediately saw how this would work out. I would have turned the meeting into a confrontation, and he probably would have put me back on the air, but it would have been some Mickey Mouse obscure demeaning role, which would not only piss me off, but would piss Bischoff off as well, because Eric didn't want me on anything. I was around since day one and seen as the old guard, one of the wrestling guys. Eric wanted a fresh start, and I understood that completely. Ironically, Watts, a few months before, had wanted me to fire Eric. Eric was our C announcer who handled the smaller shows and did the grunt work in terms of announcing. "I don't like him," Cowboy said. "He's an asshole. An asshole who answers to you, so get rid of him." "What did he do?" I asked. "Nothing. I need to send a message." "Well, then, I can't do it," I said. "Eric does a good job, and we have no reason to give corporate for firing him." Eric stayed, and now I was on the chopping block. Shaw said, "Look, this is what I would do if I was you. I would take the 6 weeks off. We're going to pay you anyway, and see what you think then. You don't have to take the syndication thing, but we're offering you a job over here that needs some help. And if you don't want to do the syndication job, then just take another 6 weeks, because we're going to keep paying you." The company didn't want me to stay, but I knew I had a contract, which raised a major problem for TBS. When they'd re-signed me under Watts, a raise was not all I got. I also received a guaranteed deal to be the voice of the Saturday night TBS show, the Clash of the Champions specials, and the pay-per-views. At the time, TBS had wanted to lock me into those roles, so their own lawyer put in writing my job specification. When my lawyer looked at it, he said, "You need to sign this right away, because you're locked into prime time. It's like being the host of Monday Night Football, and that's your gig, and if they don't want you to be the host of Monday Night Football anymore, they have to pay you your full contract." By having me out on vacation or traveling around with syndication sales, I simply wasn't going to be around the company. I was going to be sent out to the hinterlands to be forgotten until my deal ran out 3 years later. So I took the 6 weeks and went to Jamaica alone. Bad idea. After I stumbled back to the States, the mere smell of rum made me ill. It was the first vacation I'd taken in years. Problem was, I was bored just 2 weeks in. I called Jan a lot. It felt like we were getting even closer. I told her what was happening, and she was an amazing confidant who I missed dearly. I looked forward to talking with her above just about anything in my life, but I wasn't the kind for sitting around. I didn't want the money for nothing. I wanted to work for it. I wanted to earn it. Better to die of work than rust. When I came back, I decided to give the syndication and production job a try. I did get to keep one of my broadcasting jobs, too. Little did I know that my weekly report on WCW's 900 number on Saturdays was making a small fortune. And, of course, I got none of that money. Traveling around and going to the local TV stations and pitching the WCW syndicated programming was soul-destroying. I knew where I wanted to be. I knew I had much more to offer on TV. I'd gotten enough attention from fans of my work over the years that I ended up getting the same question over and over. "Jim, how come you're not on TV anymore?" It just became embarrassing, and I had had enough. I watched talent after talent, person after person, travel north to WWF over the years. It was my turn to try and do the same. Chapter 41, Vince, 1993. I decided to make two calls that would change my life, the first to Jan and the second to Bruce Pritchard. Jan and I were communicating a lot more, talking on the phone and occasionally meeting up for drinks. I didn't know how she and I would do back together. I just knew that I wanted to find out. Once Jan knew I was serious, she made her mind up too. I was ready to marry the kindest, most understanding woman I had ever met. and she was ready to settle down with a high-maintenance wrestling guy who was away from home a lot and obsessively committed to his job. I was nervous that I would be a bad husband again, but Jan was too beautiful and too smart for me to let go again. "I'm a little worried about how I'll be as a husband," I said to her. "You want to find out?" she asked. "More than anything." "Well, me too." I just realized that professionally, I needed to be back to where I felt I belonged, on air calling matches and helping the talent get over. I knew that with Eric in charge, WCW wasn't going to allow me to do that. So I rang my old friend from Mid-South, Bruce Pritchard. When Bruce first came on the scene, Cowboy didn't like him and didn't want him in his company. Bruce and I got along great. So even though Cowboy was wary, I hired Bruce to do the syndication interviews after the Sunday night Tulsa shows. Bruce really did well considering he had never done much promo work on screen before. I helped him the best I could, and he was always loyal and trustworthy to me. So as I figured out what I was going to do, and I realized I couldn't drink all the Crown Royal in Atlanta or smoke all the mysterious tobacco in Georgia, I gave Bruce, who was now a higher up in WWF, a call. I was basically sitting alone in my apartment every day and needed to do something. I had the itch. Even though I had a radio show, Wrestling with Jim Ross on AM 750 WSV, I really wanted to get back into the day-to-day side of the wrestling business. I wanted to see if I could make it in the big show. Every step I'd taken, every piece of advice I'd listened to, and every lesson I'd learned was all leading me to New York, to Vince McMahon, to WWF. I drove my navy blue two-door Lincoln Continental Mark VII from Atlanta to Augusta, Georgia, to have my first in-person meeting with Vince McMahon. I thought about the only other time I had spoken to Vince, which was on the telephone when he called the UWF office in Bixby, Oklahoma, looking for us to release Missy Hyatt. Watts didn't care to talk to McMahon, so I handled the call and agreed to the release, as Cowboy had nothing creatively for Missy at that time. I was hurtling down I-20 East, loading myself with breath mints and dabbing myself with cologne. I didn't want to arrive to what was essentially a job interview, stinking of the cigarette smoke that was wafting around in my car. When I arrived, I parked in the back of the arena where the TV trucks, talent, and crew parked. I worked that same building with WCW, so I knew my way around. I walked down the ramp to the backstage entrance of the arena without having to show any credentials or ID. The local security were the same, so they knew me and thought I was just there to say hello to a few old pals. The first guy I ran into was Jerry Briscoe. Jerry was the promoter for the town and was told to keep an eye out on my arrival. Jerry knew me, and I certainly knew him because he and his brother Jack were fellow Okies and legends in the business. "You here to see Vince?" Jerry asked. I wasn't sure how to answer, as I didn't know if our meeting was secret or not. "It's okay," he said, sensing my reluctance. "I'll go and get him for you." Vince wanted to talk before the taping started, so he could get on with producing 3 TV shows before a packed house of about 8,000 fans. I heard McMahon's familiar voice talking to someone as he approached. I instinctively pretended to be cool by whistling softly while looking in the opposite direction like this was no big thing. "Jim," Vince said as he got closer. Before I could answer, someone from production asked Vince a question. Then someone passing shook his hand. The Steiner brothers, who I knew from WCW, walked by and said hi to both me and Vince. We were standing in the quarter where all the talent arrived. Bam Bam Bigelow, Terry Taylor, Tatanka, Hacksaw Jim Duggan all stopped to say hi as well. It was great seeing old friends, but I was anxious to get my own time with Vince to see if I could land myself a spot in the company the boys were already working for. I could see by Vince's interaction with the roster that he was the kind of man who liked to get to the point. He was polite and respectful to all who passed, but didn't really engage in much small talk. He struck me as a guy who wanted to know what time it was and not how to make the watch. "How about we go outside?" he said. "Sounds good," I replied. My thinking was that McMahon and I could have our talk, then I could slip out in my trusty Lincoln and head back to Hotlanta. "I appreciate you taking the drive down," he said. "I'm glad Bruce could get us two together." "Me too." "Tell me how you got in the business," he said as he stopped in a quiet spot away from the building. I knew he didn't have long before the taping began, so I launched into my history and what my various roles were under Cowboy. Vince cackled at some of my stories and seemed to get a real kick out of certain people and wrestlers who crossed both our paths. We talked about a litany of philosophical matters, booking approaches, and my ongoing job as VP of Broadcasting for Turner Broadcasting's WCW. "What do you think we could do here to make people more aware of what we're doing?" he asked me. "Radio," I said immediately. "Nobody in wrestling is using radio properly to market their events." "Really? How so?" "You have the talent, you have the announcers, and you have the fans who want to hear more from them." I could see he was really taking in what I was saying. I continued, "For instance, you could broadcast live radio from the house shows. Give people a real taste of the excitement and the energy that comes from experiencing the matches live." I saw McMahon opening up more and more as our talk continued. Behind the name, the title, and the stories I'd heard, Vince was just a redneck from North Carolina who liked to joke, curse, and talk about wrestling. I knew I was really getting somewhere when he didn't leave to produce his shows. It was unheard of that hands-on McMahon wasn't front and center for his own TV taping, but something in our conversation made him stay. I felt some of my ideas had struck a chord with Vince, and his vision for how he wanted to build the wrestling business damn sure motivated me. I was less concerned about what position I was going to play in WWF. I just wanted to be issued a jersey. After almost 3 hours of talking about life, family, and a lot of wrestling, in the parking lot, Vince put out his hand. "I can't match your WCW salary, but I can get very close," he said. "I can also give you a signing bonus of 50 grand. What do you say?" "Deal," I said on the spot, and we shook hands. "Great. I want you to start at WrestleMania." "WrestleMania? Goddamn, what a way to introduce yourself." Vince and I shook hands once more, and that was that. We had a deal. I would be starting roughly a month or so later at WrestleMania in a yet-to-be-determined role. "I appreciate the opportunity," I said as he walked toward the building, and I walked toward my car. "You're going to fit right in around here," Vince replied. I felt an immediate connection in some crazy, wrestling way to the genius known as Vinnie Mac. I was buying what Vince was selling, and I decided there and then that WWF was the company that I wanted to finish up my pro wrestling career with. And if the boss said I was going to fit right in, then who was going to question him? Maybe the asshole that punctured all four of my tires in the parking lot. Someone obviously spotted me parking Old Blue and either decided to rib me or simply be a tool and slash all my tires. I was 150 miles away from my Atlanta home with four flat wheels on a weeknight with no phone booth in sight to call anyone and no one to call even if I could find one. Thankfully, one of the friendly security guards knew a local service station where they sent their wrecker to tow me to their shop. I bought four used mismatched tires, which were barely good enough to get me back to Atlanta. As soon as I arrived home, I had a call on my machine from Bruce Pritchard. I called back. "Vince is pissed," Bruce said. Panic hit me all at once as I thought he'd changed his mind. "Why?" "'Cause he heard what happened to your car, Jim. I was relieved to hear it wasn't anything to do with our meeting. Really? Tell him it's fine and that I'm looking forward to coming to work with you guys. Vince wants to pay for the damage. What did it cost you? Bruce asked. Through Bruce, I politely refused Vince's generosity. It was my issue, and I wanted to get that negativity off Vince's radar as soon as possible. I got my dream job, and I couldn't wait to launch the beginning of the next biggest, most daunting part of my entire career. Vince said I'd fit right in, I said to Bruce over the phone. You think so? Bruce paused. Yeah, he replied, obviously lying. Chapter 42, WCW Radio, 1993. When my deal with WWF became official, I wanted to make a big splash with the news. I thought, I'm not going to be a part of the Turner family, except getting their nice checks every other week, so I wanted to elevate my radio show by opening it up a bit. WCW was a sponsor of Wrestling with Jim Ross, but they did not own it. They had no claim to my guest list and no further claim to me. I knew WSB wasn't a minor station either. WSB was the station in Atlanta, and the second word got out that WWF Chairman Vince McMahon was coming on the show, my phone started ringing. I heard from Jim Barnett and the TVS lawyers who wanted to know what I was doing. They had the mistaken belief that they owned or controlled my show. None of the contracts with the advertisers were in WCW's name, I explained. The deals were all cut between me and the advertisers directly. I knew a guy like Bob Hughes who became a great friend and was in charge of the massive advertising budget at Georgia Power. Was irate that WCW were treating me like dirt. WCW couldn't have moved his advertising from my show with a stick of dynamite. Not a single business canceled advertising after WWF personalities started appearing on my show, not least of which was the WWF chairman himself, who came on live on air to tell the wrestling world that I was their new signee. Vince said that I was the business premier announcer and that Christmas had come early for his company. It's the equivalent of John Madden jumping from CBS to NBC, he said. I got calls and mail from listeners in 37 states who said they were in wrestling heaven because my one-dimensional WCW-centric show was now bringing on the superstars from the other side. The station had a meter which could measure how many people were calling or trying to call, and we had the most call radio show on the station. It was an amazing hit because wrestling fans finally had an outlet to communicate. Of course, the WCW lawyers began to push it a little too far, so someone in WCW had to step in. They had to come clean. The reason Jim Ross could jump ship so cleanly was because the management of WCW screwed up. WCW had reassigned me, therefore voiding their own terms and breaking their own contract with me. I was free to jump and be welcomed with open arms to the WWF. Chapter 43, WrestleMania 9, 1993. You're sure you're okay wearing that, pal? Vince asked me. I was standing backstage at Caesar's Palace wearing a toga and some sandals. Well, it's the world's largest toga party, right? I said, referencing WWF's theme for the show. That's right, Vince said. Then I'm sure as hell joining the party. I was ready to debut for WWF at their biggest event of the year, WrestleMania 9, where the company drew inspiration from their Roman surroundings to create a Colosseum theme. They hired actors to play Cleopatra and Julius Caesar. I saw elephants backstage and ostriches, buzzards, centurions, and Vestal Virgins walking around. There were costume designers in rehearsals, lines to learn for the show opening, and a new broadcast team to work with. I was a long way from home. Apart from me, Howard Finkel had a costume, Gorilla Monsoon had a costume, and Bobby Heenan had a costume. The only person that didn't wear a period piece was Macho Man Randy Savage. I don't know if that was because he refused or it went against his gimmick, but either way, I was too busy to think about it. It was my first week on the job, my first ever WWF pay-per-view, a WrestleMania, and I was ready to show the entirely new audience what I could do. It didn't matter to me what they dressed me in. I was solely focused on what the audience was about to hear, not see. Vince even gave me the option of wearing a suit if I was uncomfortable in the toga. "You ready?" asked a familiar voice from behind me. It was Gorilla Monsoon. "I was just trying to remember my lines," I said in reply. Gorilla was a huge man, a legend in the business, and the voice of WWF. But he didn't look well. His health wasn't strong in general, but it had certainly slid farther after his son and WWF referee Joey Morella died in a car crash 10 months before. Gorilla smiled and said to me, "You're going to do great." Monsoon's words were a huge comfort. We had a big production meeting the day before, and I wasn't exactly welcomed with open arms by the vast majority of WWF employees. I was known as the voice of the enemy. But Gorilla stood out as being friendly and helpful right from the beginning. "Energy," Vince reminded me. "Give me energy out there." As we went live, Monsoon's voice was the first to be heard on the WrestleMania 9 broadcast. He would have done the play-by-play as well if he wasn't so clearly ill. He got into his costume, did the intro at the very top of the show, and then pitched it down to the newest member of the broadcast team, Jim Ross. It was showtime for me, in the biggest wrestling company in the world. "It will be a day of firsts, ladies and gentlemen," I said with all the excitement and passion I could muster. "My very first WrestleMania. First time that yours truly, from the great state of Oklahoma, has ever been in a toga myself. This is quite an impressive outfit, and I, too, could get used to this. What do you think of these gold shoes?" I said, showing the camera my perfectly appointed golden sandals. "How would those play in Tulsa?" As I took over, Gorilla went back to his room to rest. I wrapped up my intro, ran down the top of the card, and nailed all the lines I had to remember. I moved down to ringside and waited for my broadcast colleagues, Bobby the Brain Heenan and Randy Savage, to make their entrance down the aisle. My head was full of little things to worry about. I wasn't so much concerned about getting the wrestlers over or calling a compelling match. I was more worried about it being daylight and outdoors, which would cause glare on my monitor, or making sure I facilitated both Savage and Heenan in their role, as I had never done a three-man booth for a whole pay-per-view before. And certainly not one that just happened to be the biggest event of the year for the company and the entire business. I was aware of all the changes, all the things I had to get used to as we went live across the world. I was also aware that I was on top of the world. I loved feeling the rush, the fact that there was no safety net. As I settled at ringside, Bruce Prichard introduced himself in my headset. The music hit for the first match, and I sat down in my seat to lead my two vastly different new colleagues into the fray. Randy was challenging to work with right from the get-go. I could hear right away that I was going to earn my money with Macho. He kept me on my toes, and not in a negative way, as soon as the pay-per-view began. I had no idea exactly where he was going in his commentary, so it was hard for me to direct traffic. Randy was wound tight at the best of times, but this was WrestleMania, and he didn't seem to like the fact he had to get used to a new partner, me, live on pay-per-view. I had heard that Savage, historically, was not an overly trusting individual. It was just the nature of his personality. so he committed to working his own style, and I had to follow. Heenan, on the other hand, was just the opposite. He was loose and funny and made my job easy. I knew Bobby was good from watching his stuff on TV, but I had no idea just how good he was until I sat beside him and went live. When I thought of all the tools that someone can bring into the wrestling business, I could see nobody had more to offer than Bobby Heenan. I was a huge fan of his wrestling and on-air role as a manager. And now after working with him as an announcer, I left the booth looking at Bobby Heenan as the best total wrestling package ever. I knew he was an extraordinarily underrated in-ring talent. He took the greatest ass-whippings in the history of the sport and could feed a comeback as a heel to make a babyface look like Superman, as good as any heel I ever saw. Then the very next week, after being mutilated and disfigured, he'd get back on the microphone and talk his heat right back to where it was. He was an artisan. When it was time to step back from the ring, Bobby became a broadcaster with no broadcast training. I don't even think he had a high school degree, but the brain was a genius commentator. Our first outing at WrestleMania was enough proof for me that Bobby Heenan and I had natural chemistry on screen, but I would soon rely on his friendship off screen to help navigate the confusing world of WWF. Chapter 44, Growing Pains, 1993. I got the feeling almost immediately that the people in WWF hated my guts. Not me the person, but me the guy Vince hired from the competition and didn't tell anyone about. McMahon was the alpha male, and he didn't often ask for people's feedback or suggestions. He simply hired me because he thought I could contribute to the success of his company. What that meant on the ground was some people in the production and television side were reluctant to open up and didn't want to lower their guard and trust me. I was a WCW guy to them, coming over to take their spot. I knew I had to prove myself and was waiting outside the Stanford studios to do just that when a big Cadillac pulled up. The license plate read, K-Fabe. Inside, I could see the smiling face of Gorilla Monsoon looking back at me. I stubbed out my cigarette and walked toward his car. Gorilla was a former main event wrestler and a trusted confidant of McMahon's, who was so well respected that they named the backstage section just behind the curtain the Gorilla position after him. "Nice ride," I said. "You'd like to drive?" Gorilla asked me. "I started out driving for Leroy McGurk in a car just like this one," I said as I looked the Cadillac up and down. "Well, I'm more or less blind now, Jim. How about we ride together when we go on the road?" "Love to. If we're renting a car, I need something with leather seats. I can't get out of the car if it has regular cloth seats." "Got it." I was just thrilled that someone with so much clout was taking a shine to me. Gorilla opened the door for me to enter the building. It was my first weekend of TV, and Monsoon was already looking out for me. I was there to team with Bobby the Brain Heenan for a show called Wrestling Challenge, which was one of two syndicated shows that WWF produced. I knew when I entered the studio that the reception for me was cool, to say the least. Some would say it was hostile. Gorilla, feeling it too, smiled and ushered me in. "What do I have to do to let people know I'm not the enemy?" I asked him. "You want the truth?" I nodded. "I'm not sure," he said. "This is pretty bad." Little did I know it was the mixture of Bobby, me, and the catering guy that would turn my fortunes around with the crew. After a couple of weeks working with the Brain, he leaned into me and said, "You know, they used to hate you around here." "I know," I replied. Then it hit me. "Wait a minute, they used to?" "It's the catering," Bobby said. "The food?" I asked, confused as to what Heenan was alluding to. "Vince and Savage are here the day before us," he explained. That means pasta, salad, and chicken breast. Then me, you, and Gorilla come in to do our work. Bobby waited until I caught up with him. Nothing but desserts, meatballs, potato salads, and soda. The crew can't wait for you to come back every week. They love you. They do? Well, no. But they tolerate you. That's a start. He was right. It was a start. I had nothing to do with the menu, but when Heenan, Monsoon, and I were there, the catering guys would order the food we liked. Hideously bad, fattening, carbohydrate-loaded foods, and chocolate cake to finish. The food got me some love to begin with, and the crew began to see Bobby and I had great chemistry. We didn't overthink things, and we hit our marks, and we got the job done. We would normally do all 3 hours of our TV show in just 4 hours of taping. That included pee breaks and dinner breaks. I quickly learned that nothing will endear you to a hostile crew like unhealthy food and shorter hours. On the other days, when Vince was involved, the time needed would go into the evening hours because McMahon had so many interruptions between takes. He was chairman of the board and had a lot of irons in the fire. When someone would call over, they'd have to interrupt the voiceovers so Vince could take the phone call or fix a problem. The tapings were stop and go, stop and go, stop and go. Bobby and I, we just nailed our business with no fuss and no waiting around. I quickly came to love working with Bobby and Gorilla, and they both accepted me because they liked how I started in the business, working for little money and paying my dues. My story seemed to resonate with the two veterans, who then would communicate that to the people who worked for WWF. I needed all the help I could get, as the crew weren't my only detractors. I was even shunned by other broadcasters like Lord Alfred Hayes. Hayes was an Englishman who was a good wrestler and a heel manager before settling in WWF as a broadcaster in his later years. I never even met him, didn't know him, but still he treated me like I had malaria or some other infectious disease. He was rude and unprofessional until Monsoon and Heenan got wind of it. Gorilla had a quiet word with his lordship, after which Alfred and I became famous friends. We had fun and drank together. He loved to drink wine and regale us with the stories of his days in the UK or his time working for Bob Geigel, the NWA promoter who was eventually bought out by Jim Crockett. We soon found out we had mutual friends that we'd met on the territory circuit. Bit by bit, person by person, I could feel I was making ground in the company. Bill Watts had told me years before that Gorilla Monsoon was one of the truly good guys, and he was right. Heenan and Monsoon both knew I wasn't some fresh kid from broadcasting school. I was a territory guy. I rode up and down the roads with the guys getting my hands dirty. I refereed. I was one of the ring crew. I was one of the boys. But that didn't protect me from everyone. It was an odd feeling getting pulled out of a studio by a volatile former WWF champion. At first, I panicked at the sheer sight of his wild eyes as he stomped toward me. Then the second before he grabbed me, I thought he was joking because he seemed to be in character. One thing I soon learned about Macho Man Randy Savage was he wasn't in character. What you saw on TV was him. He was that intense. First thing in the morning to the last thing at night. All that's well and good until he turns that intensity in your direction. Get out, he shouted as he pushed out through the door of the studio into the hallway. All I could think was, I'm about to get my ass beat by the Macho Man. Holy shit, it's happening. Who put you up to it, he shouted in my face. Who got you, yeah, to bring me in here to do all this work? I whispered through my dry mouth, I don't know what you're talking about. He didn't like that reply at all. He shouted, you keep bringing me in here to do these interviews, and I'm not even booked to be here. Clearly someone had been in Randy's ear, stirring him up. Are you goddamn ribbing me, Ross? Randy, I said, you're a household name. I want to get you on TV to help get those angles over. For shut up! His eyes were wild, and he was talking a little to himself and a little to me. You think it's funny bringing me up here to do this shit, do you? And then the surreal got dangerous. He stuck his finger in my face and put his other hand around my neck and began to squeeze. Because if you think that you're Randy, a familiar voice from down the hall, the boys are working you. I managed to tilt my head a little to see Gorilla Monsoon walk toward us. This asshole, Randy said to Gorilla about me, he's bringing me to do these promos because he thinks it's funny. Yeah, to bring the Macho Man in to do promos. Yeah. Jim is just doing his job. It's the boys who are ribbing you, said Gorilla. Macho Man looked right back at me. He already had me pinned against the wall and pretty much peeing on myself. He leaned his head in against mine until we were nose to nose. I'm going to find out, he said, and when I do, you're not going to do anything, Gorilla said, standing behind Randy. I strongly suggest you take your leave. Randy was breathing deeply. The veins in his neck were popping out, and the finger he had in my face was nearly pushed through to the back of my head. I mean it, Gorilla said. Let him go. Macho released his grip and turned to Monsoon. I certainly didn't want Gorilla at his age to get into anything physical. I don't think Randy did either. Macho stood down out of respect for Gorilla, then stormed off. You okay, Gorilla asked. I'm fine, I said. Lucky I'm wearing dark trousers. He's intense, isn't he? Gorilla said, laughing. I'm learning that. Let's get back to work. Gorilla was like the uncle I never had. I didn't dislike Randy at all. He was just so amazingly unpredictable and talented. I had never been around anybody like him before. I think I might stop booking Macho in interviews, I said to Monsoon as he walked slowly back to the studio door. I think that's best, Gorilla answered. Again, the most powerful weapon in wrestling came out, the eraser. In the wrestling business, I learned we all worked in pencil. So I erased Randy's name, put somebody else's in there, and went about my business. Not everyone here dislikes you, you know, added Gorilla. I knew that. I had already made some interesting friends. Chapter 45, Making Friends, 1993. I found myself in a basement full of pot smoke, sitting in a chair under a light, getting a haircut. For all the unwelcoming people in WWF, there was also an amazing counterbalance of people who welcomed me like one of their own. Pat Patterson was one of those guys. Pat was a territory guy who overcame giant obstacles within the good old boy territory network to carve out a Hall of Fame career for himself. Pat was a French-Canadian who left his home in Montreal as a boy without knowing a word of English to come to the United States for work. He earned some money and learned to speak English along the way until he found his calling in professional wrestling. Pat was also gay, and homophobia was as prominent as racism back in the day, particularly in the wrestling business. Still, he made himself a star in the ring and invaluable to Vince outside the ring. Pat had a brilliant mind and was a wonderful sounding board for Vince as McMahon was really heavy on sizzle and creating an attraction, while Pat was more rooted in the fundamentals of wrestling. Pat was a showman, too, but he had infinite knowledge of the business and wouldn't deviate too far from what got people over. For me, Pat's house became a sanctuary, a welcoming home in a new city where the door was always open. Jan was a flight attendant for U.S. Airways and was gone a lot. Her flight schedule rotated every week, and she was based out of Philadelphia, which meant she took the train from Stanford to Philly and then would catch her flights and go to work. With Jan gone so much, it was nice to have somewhere to go that didn't involve a bar or an airplane. Pat's longtime partner, Louis Dondero, was an amazing host, as well as generous, funny, and a licensed hairstylist. How's Jan? Louis asked me as he looked for his scissors. I was down in Pat and Louis's basement in the barber's chair while Pat looked on. "She's doing good, traveling a lot," I replied. Louie joked, "Now, it was a perm you asked for, wasn't it?" Beyond the haze of Louie's pot smoke, I could see Pat laughing. Pat never smoked. He liked a vodka cocktail, but I never saw him smoke even a joint. Louie, on the other hand, was something of a connoisseur. "If you can find enough hair to perm, you go right ahead, Louie," I said. "I'd love to see you ride back to Oklahoma with your hair perm," Pat laughed. The visual got everyone laughing. "What do you think old cowboy Watts would think of that, Jimbo?" "I don't think Bill would be too impressed," I said. "As I remember it, he wasn't too big on men with perms." "Unless you're a free bird," Pat howled. And once again, it struck me just how far I was from home. Even though I was a grown man, I still missed my hometown, my mom and my dad, the cinema, and the dollar for a haircut. But I was sure I was in the right place. I loved wrestling. I loved working for the biggest wrestling company on earth. And I loved being with friends. "You got any plans to make an honest woman out of Jan?" Louie asked me. "I do indeed," I replied. "Just got to let things settle down at work first." "Are you fitting in okay?" Pat asked as he slid his chair in a little closer. "It's been quite the journey, Pat," I said, trying to be as diplomatic as I could. "Some days I go to lunch and people don't want to sit with me. Won't even talk if I say hello." "Ah, fuck them," Pat shouted. "You're here with us now." Nothing annoyed Pat more than someone being singled out. "And Vince has been hinting at me becoming a character, too," I said. "I'm not sure how to handle that one." Pat smiled. He took a second before deciding he could confide in me a little. "Some of the thing with Vince," he said, his accent still struggling with plurals, "I'm not keen on. Everybody has to be a character. You have to be a policeman or a garbage man or whatever." "He wants me to wear a cowboy hat," I said. Pat replied, "He's not going to let go, you know. If he sees you in his mind in a cowboy hat, then you're going to be in a cowboy hat." "I don't think so," I said defiantly. Pat laughed and shook his head. "Okay," he said, "we'll see." Chapter 46, In Sickness and in Health, 1993-1994. Chan and I got married at the Little White Chapel in Las Vegas on October 12, 1993. That was also where such luminaries as Steve Austin, Michael Jordan, Mickey Rooney, and perhaps the most luminously of them all, Bruce Brother Love Pritchard, had also gotten married. We left the hotel, went to the courthouse to get a license, and made a reservation at the chapel. The whole deal took about an hour. It was my third wedding and Jan's first, but neither of us was interested in a big church wedding. We just wanted to be married. Of all the things that had happened to me during my years in wrestling, that little wedding was the best. There was no match, no WrestleMania, no contract that exceeded marrying Jan. I was ready to start the new phase of my life. New job, new wife, new home, new start. And I couldn't wait. My $50,000 signing bonus arrived in the mail, which turned out to be for $32,000. Uncle Sam helped himself to $18,000 in taxes somewhere along the way. Welcome to reality, I thought. Still, I'd never gotten a $50,000 check before in my career, and I'd already been in the business for 19 years. After WrestleMania 9, I worked the King of the Ring pay-per-view, after which Vince came back on TV, and I went to the bench. I went from debuting at WrestleMania to doing some international voiceovers and grunt work in booking the syndicated promos and the talent that went with them. I watched the shows, heard the commentary, and wondered what Vince had in store for me. I began to judge myself harshly. Was it my look, my accent, or maybe I wasn't talented enough? One thing I knew for sure, I was hungrier than ever to get back on TV and show Vince and the wrestling world what I could do. I was very aware that my contract was only for 12 months, and I didn't want to run down the remaining months sitting on the sidelines, unable to prove my worth. I wanted to re-sign and felt that nothing was going to get in my way of doing that, or at least nothing I could control. The doctor said, "I have Lyme's disease," I said, sitting at home. "Lyme's disease?" Bruce Pritchard asked over the phone. "Don't you get that from licking rocks?" "I don't think so, Bruce." The first attack happened in my sleep, the morning of Super Bowl 28, and I didn't even know it until well after I'd woken up. I went into the bathroom to brush my teeth, and I looked into the mirror. My face was hanging, and one of my eyes was drooping lower than the other. I didn't feel anything. I didn't even think anything was wrong until I looked in the mirror, but when I saw what I saw, I thought I was having a stroke. Jan was en route home on a train from Philly, so I packed myself in the car and drove to the ER as fast as I could. Along the way, I catch glimpses of myself in the rearview mirror and startled myself all over again. My face had no symmetry. My eyes didn't line up. My mouth was drooped down on one side. It was a scary thing to see my features change so dramatically and not even know why. But I found out today when I went to the neurologist that the doctor who said I had Lyme's disease was wrong, I continued. Bruce replied, "If it's not Lyme's disease, what is it?" I picked up the report from the neurologist and read the words Bell's palsy down my phone. "I have no idea what that is either," Bruce said. "It's facial paralysis," I said. "They don't know what caused it, but he says that most people get over it in a couple of weeks." "So you're going to be okay?" Bruce asked. 6 to 8 weeks, and I'll be good as new," I said. "Tell Vince I won't be down long." Chapter 47, In and Out, 1994. "Vince needs you to come in." It was Lisa Wolf, head of human resources for WWF, on the phone. "Today?" I asked. "Right away," she replied. It was icy, snowy road conditions. The only thing that was open was I-95 because the side streets hadn't been plowed yet. It was one of those days where the weatherman would say, "If you don't have to get out, don't do it." It was a Friday, and they couldn't seem to wait until the next Monday when the weather cleared up. I only lived about 20 minutes from the office, but it took me over an hour because of the driving conditions. I didn't want to go anywhere. It was less than 2 weeks since I'd had my Bell's palsy attack, and I was in bed when the call came. My face was still paralyzed, and I was suffering from blinding headaches, poor vision, and numbness across the left side of my face. When I sat opposite Vince in his office, I knew something wasn't right. Lisa was there, too, which was an indication. I knew from experience that it's never a good thing when the boss and the head of HR set you down. His words to me were very simple. "I'm changing my plans, and you aren't in them, so I'm going to let you go." My contract wasn't up for another 4 months or so. I said, "When are you letting me go?" "Now, today," Vince replied. I constantly wiped my eye and mouth because of my attack. I said, "Well, what about my contract? I don't understand you letting me go with no notice." Vince hesitated in the answer. That's when I said, "I've always heard you were a man of your word. I made a commitment to stay here through May. And even though you don't want me, I am surprised you're not going to honor your end of the contract." Before McMahon could say anything, Lisa said, "Well, that's something Vince and I will discuss." "We're not talking about another year," I continued. "We're talking about a couple more months until my contract is up. It will let me figure out what I'm going to do. And I thought you'd want to keep your word." Both Vince and Lisa didn't commit one way or the other, and then I left. I got back in my car and drove home on the frosty, slick I-95 to tell my new wife I'd been fired. We had been married just 4 months, moved to Connecticut, set up a new house, and now I was let go. At first, Jan thought I was kidding her, but she quickly saw there was no joke in what I was saying. "Why?" she asked. "I'm not sure." "Is it because of your face?" Jan wondered. "I hope not. I'd like to think Vince isn't that cruel." "Me too." "It might have been because I was reluctant to play the character they wanted, the good old Southern boy with a cowboy hat." "Honey, don't worry," she said. "It'll all be fine, and we're in this together, and we'll figure something out." "I think we should move back to Atlanta," I said. She agreed. Jan liked Atlanta, and by moving back there, she could commute out of Atlanta as opposed to going from Wilton, Connecticut, by train to Philadelphia. It would be a lot easier on her. "I'm sorry," I said. I was just about all beaten up. I'd lost my dream job not even a year after getting it. It brought back up the sickening, familiar feelings of being a failure. Jan hugged me, but I didn't feel like a very good husband. I was bringing all these issues into our new household. My illness, unemployment, two ex-wives, and the complications that that brought. Jan acquired a lot of baggage that I didn't want her to have to inherit. I just didn't know where I was going to earn the kind of money that would continue to put my two daughters through school and college while keeping enough to support my life with Jan, too. The only thing I could think of was that I had a lot of business contacts in Atlanta, and the housing market was much more affordable than in Connecticut. A few weeks later, I met Jan at the Westchester County Airport, and we had all of our stuff already on the moving van on its way to Atlanta. She and I embarked on our journey, and we drove most of the night, stopping somewhere in the Carolinas to eat and sleep. We made it back to Atlanta, and within a couple of weeks bought a townhouse on Sheffield Glen Way. It had a two-car garage and was part of a larger complex. It was very reasonable compared to Connecticut. There was no yard work, and it was only about a 5-minute drive to Fat Matt's Rib Shack. There's always a silver lining. Once we got settled, I made an attempt to get back with WCW. Unfortunately, Eric Bischoff was not interested in bringing me back. We had one meeting at a place not too far from the WCW offices, a little restaurant. Eric didn't give me any false hope. I'll give him that. He said, "I wanted to meet with you because I just don't think it's going to be happening." I was a little taken aback by his forthright take, but appreciated his honesty all the same. He continued, "I don't know that it fits anymore, and to bring him back would upset too many people." I didn't know which people he was talking about, but knew it could have been a few different factions. I had been in the wrestling business about 20 years. And I knew full well that sometimes the political winds were at your back, and other times they were gusting right in your face. At that point, I just washed my hands of the wrestling business. I had a good run and felt it was time to move on, but not before I did one favor for an old friend. Jim Cornette had left WCW a few years before after a final blowout with Herd and Ole. Corny wasn't the kind to sit idle, so within a year of his leaving, he opened up Smoky Mountain Wrestling. When Corny heard I was a free agent, he offered me $300 to come and take 2 one-hour shows for him. It was a 6 or 7 hour drive one way, so it wasn't like I was on Easy Street. Between paying for gas and food, I couldn't really justify a hotel. I just sucked it up and drove there and drove back, getting home at 7 the next morning. I was happy to help a friend while having some fun doing a little old-school wrestling. It was very nostalgic for me, and I enjoyed being around JC. The guys were happy I was there. I had a pretty good run as an announcer by the time I started doing Smoky Mountain Wrestling. I'd done clashes and pay-per-views and WrestleMania. So I had a little bit more street cred. There was some amazing talent hiding out there, too, including a guy named Glenn Jacobs. Glenn was Unabomber with a mask. He had that great look, was college-educated, soft-spoken, and classy. I thought if Vince could see this guy, he would want him on his roster. Underneath the size and potential, Glenn immediately struck me as a model employee. I knew it would be a benefit to both